happened in my very first film, Johnny Suede. I met this young unknown actor who had come in to audition for me. This was my first film. You know, we had looked and looked and looked and could not find someone to play this part because either they just were too stupid or they didn't get it, that there was a vulnerability to this character. And my casting director said to me, there's this young guy coming in today. You know, when you look at his resume, don't be freaked. He's got one little tiny Canadian TV series on it and this movie that's just finished shooting that nobody has seen called Thelma and Louise. I looked at his picture. I said, he looks interesting. Bring him in. The second I saw Brad Pitt walk in, I said two things. A, this is my guy. This is Johnny Suede. And B, this guy's going to be a star. All right. I cast him. I called the agent. Yep, you're cast. My producer goes, whoa. What are you talking about? You're not casting that guy. I said, what? This was like a $500,000 movie in 1991. He goes, yeah, I'm not paying for that guy. He's nobody. He refused to compromise in any way. I had to turn my back on this guy's money. That's how confident I was that Brad was the guy.
Hey everybody, you're listening to FilmWax Radio. I'm your host, Adam Chartoff. This is episode number 412. Welcome back for another episode this week. This is the second episode. We posted an episode on the Maryland Film Festival a couple of days ago. I'm back with a brand new episode. I wanted to get this up today because Tom DiCillo, who has been on my podcast before, he was on episode 321 from the Woodstock Film Festival a couple of years ago, and he's back finally, whereby he is finally getting a screening here in New York City of his new film. To say it's a documentary is not really accurate. It's a work of nonfiction, let's put it that way. And it's called Down in Shadowland, and it is going to be screening at the IFC Center on Monday, June the 19th. I will be there. There is going to be a Q&A with Steve Buscemi moderating, and it should be a great evening. So I don't know if there's any tickets left, but you can check by going to the IFC Center's website and checking it out if you live in the New York City area. Regardless, hopefully you'll have an opportunity to see Down in Shadowland at some point soon. It's an unusual film for Tom. He's never really made a film like this, but it's extremely personal. And speaking of personal, we do get somewhat personal in this conversation. Since I had Tom on last time, we've gotten to know each other somewhat well and, you know, become friends. He's gone through a very, very turbulent period of time in the last year. He lost his wife and he made this film, and it, you know, so it's an extremely intense period of time. But he's an artist, and so the work that he's creating kind of reflects where he's at right now. Anyway, so I went up to see Tom in his apartment on the Upper West Side a few weeks ago when we recorded this, and I'm happy to post it for you on episode number 412. So we're going to go into that in just a minute. I want to thank my friends at Magic Drop. We're going to do a little commercial in a minute, but it's been great having them on the last bunch of episodes. If you're a filmmaker and if you have licensing issues with the music you're using, listen to this, please. Magic Drop is a music licensing business based in Brooklyn, New York, which represents an eclectic roster of bands and composers licensing their music for use in films, TV, and beyond. Magic Drop works directly with clients to find songs or instrumentals from a catalog of 1,000-plus tracks by artists with distinctive developed voices. Magic Drop offers competitive rates and festival licenses for independent filmmakers. Visit magicdropmusic.com or email contact@magicdropmusic.com for more information. Again, that's Magic Drop. So we thank our friends at Magic Drop for sponsoring the last half dozen episodes of the podcast. After Tom's appearance, we're going to go into another segment, this one with Karen Cooper. I had Bruce Goldstein on a few months ago. Well, now Karen Cooper. Both are from Film Forum, and Karen programs the contemporary cinema and whereas Bruce does the repertory. So they both work alongside one another. And Karen Cooper wanted her on for years, finally got her on. So you're going to hear my conversation with a real institution, not just Film Forum, but Karen Cooper herself, a real New York film institution. We'll get to that in just a little while. But first up here, let's see, Tom Ticciolo came on the scene in the early 90s, I guess. I first, of course, ran into him a little earlier than that when I accidentally walked into Stranger Than Paradise, the Jim Jarmusch movie, and Tom shot that movie. He was a downtowner. He moved to New York not that long before and got caught up in the whole art scene, ended up going to NYU Film School and making some seminal films, including Johnny Suede, which he talks about on this coming episode, and Living in Oblivion. Those two movies were part of a whole movement of independent film coming out of New York in the 90s. Subsequently, he has made Box of Moonlight. He's made Delirious. He made a Doors film, The Doors, When You're Strange. And now he has this new film called Down at Shadowlands. Without any further delay, let's get into this, my conversation with the returning Tom Ticciolo here on Filmwax Radio.
There's sunlight in your hair, sunlight in your smile, and the brightest flash of summer in your eyes. But behind the summer sun, there lies a darker one, and it brings the bitter.
How are you? I'm good. I'm really excited about this film. Mm-hmm. It has taken quite a while to find the finished form of it, and mm-hmm. I really feel confident that I have. Yeah. And just the other day, I looked at the finished print of it with a brand new sound mix that I did, and I'm really, really pleased with the way it came together. Mm-hmm. It's lean. Started shooting this film, I believe, in 2007 or 2009.
Wow, yeah.
You can imagine the amount of footage that I have. And to glean it so yeah. that I only took the stuff that I felt was the most real and the most powerful, I feel like I did that. Mm-hmm. And that was the editing, actually, was the toughest part of this whole movie.
Right.
Was finding a shape for it, finding a form, and then structuring it. So I'm excited. You know, there'll be 200 people sitting watching this movie.
Right. At the IFC Center.
At the IFC.
On June
19th. At 7:30. And Steve Buscemi is going to introduce the film and do a Q&A with me. So that's great. I just sent him the film, and he just wrote me back the most amazing email in which he was talking about how much he was moved and impressed by the film. And it was completely unsolicited. I didn't ask him for that. And it meant so much to me. I mean, he kind of implied that he thought it was one of my best movies, which, mm-hmm. listen, whether I agree or I don't agree, it's hard to, like, say whether I do or I don't without sounding somewhat self-involved, right? But you know, there was a reason why I continued to work on this movie for over 8 years. It's because I believed in it. Mm-hmm. And it was very encouraging to hear Steve access what it was that I was trying to do with the film,
mm-hmm.
you know, effortlessly.
So. Mm. Well, maybe at some point I'll have an opportunity to bring him on and ask him directly. You know? I hadn't seen Down in Shadowland, which is the film we've been talking about, before I met you. I saw it literally the night before we sat down,
right?
And which was, I guess, one of your somewhat earlier draft of the
right.
film.
Yes, yeah, so it has changed quite a bit since then.
Yeah, and I've seen one since. I wonder if it's changed since, because at one point you sent me a disc or mm-hmm. gave me one with a newer edit,
right?
And a more updated edit, which I could see, you know, this guy's putting a lot of work into this film.
Yeah.
But just based also on your earlier films, yeah, I just felt this is somebody I can relate to, at least in terms of his artistic vision.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I got that from your earlier films. So,
well, thank you.
Yeah. So in all this time, though, and I know you have had going through, you know, obviously a lot of personal stuff has been going on the last couple of years.
Right.
That's probably taken up a lot of your time. Has this been, in a way, a real, has it been for you, this film, without sounding cliche, but has it been a help to have, to lean on this work in a way?
And that's a really good question, Adam. One of the, you know, the real privileges and advantages of doing something on your own is that you can work on it whenever you want to. And I shot this film myself. I edited it right here. Uh-huh. Most of the music that's in it that I composed right here. And so, you know, literally, you know, at 10 o'clock at night, if I felt like, you know, going back in and tweaking and relooking and you know, working on a section, reworking it, I could do it. And there is something really freeing about that. I've often felt that in some of my, you know, financed films, that the structure of, you know, when you shoot, the structure of when you edit,
everything,
it's like, you know, one film sort of squeaked through where I feel like everything that I wanted to put in it is in it, and that was Living in Oblivion. Mm-hmm. Because in a way, I think only one scene ended up not in the movie.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's yes. Quite a...
it is. But so...
That's amazing, actually.
I mean, what I loved about this project was that it started out as just... It started out on the shot level. In other words, I'd be sitting on the train, and I'd see something happening. And I go, wow, I wish I had my camera. Now, not a still camera, although a still photographer really influenced me. Gary Winogrand, you know, he's a black and white photographer.
Street photographer?
He was in the 60s. I have his book over here. I'll show you.
Oh, yeah. I'd love to see it.
Mm-hmm. But he captured these moments of just human interaction or people being alone that just spoke volumes, you know. And I said to myself, I wonder if I could do that with the movie camera, you know. And so I started shooting, and, you know, I got some amazing footage, you know. But then the question, of course, became, well, how do you put it all together? You know, what, as interesting as some of these shots were, the idea of somebody just sitting there staring at shot after shot was daunting, because who would want to do that? I wouldn't want to do that, you know. But just the fact that I could go out and shoot whenever I wanted to shoot, whatever I wanted to shoot, was, I don't know, I just, it enabled me to discover a form of filmmaking that felt very real to me, which was, I get a bunch of broad strokes, all these shots that I shot, then I could look at it. It's almost like, you know, poetry, and you say, okay, do these words go together? What's the emotion that comes from these three shots going together?
Right.
Okay, then you take those three shots and you put 20 shots together, and you have kind of a scene. And you go, okay, what's that telling me? Where's that going? And I was kind of writing the film as I was shooting and editing. And I, you know, hopefully, you know, the next film won't take 9 years. But I feel that...
I hope so, too.
I feel that the work that went into it is very evident in the film.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like looking at a piece of architecture or something. You look at it at Notre Dame. I'm not comparing my film to Notre Dame, but I'm saying,
yeah, it's much better.
Well, you,
I know what you're saying.
You look at the centuries of work that went into building the cathedral, and you know you have to stand back and you know, have some awe about it.
You know what I mean? Well, could you have made any other kind of film project would have been competing for a lot of your time and your energy,
right.
in the last couple of years anyway, maybe.
That's true.
Maybe a few years. Did your wife get to see this work? Did she get to see it?
Yes, yeah, she did. Mm-hmm. She did, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, you're referring to the fact that my wife passed away in October, and it was intense. It still is. She had a 2-year battle with leukemia, and I stopped everything just to take care of her. I don't regret a second of it. You know, I think about her constantly. And, you know, she saw what I was doing and you know, always a little like, since it wasn't a financed film, I was paying for it. She had a, you know, a little bit of anxiety about what the hell I was doing. And, you know,
are you going to be okay?
It, well, also, you know, how much was I going to spend?
Yeah.
You know,
right. It could be a sinkhole or whatever you want to call it.
But she liked it. She liked it a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a very personal film. And I just say to myself, especially today, you know, the only thing that matters really is that it's something that is truly meaningful to you. That's it. That's all that matters.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not saying that it's a piece of work that is only meaningful to me, because if I felt that, I never would have made it. Mm-hmm. You know, as an artist, I think I'm able to discern and to tell, okay, this is just something for me.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, and to always know that, you know what, well, I do think audiences would appreciate this. And I put a lot of thought into keeping that in mind. You know,
the photographer you mentioned, Gary
Winograd. Right.
Winograd. He was obviously was an inspiration. Was there anything else? Because every other step of the way, it seems like you've been doing this alone. Even I'm letting myself edit here. Even like even your essentially your exhibition phase, you've been doing on your own.
Right.
But maybe for that stage, as this was forming in your mind, as it was percolating, you were open to other things other than that.
Yeah,
photo
essay. The early sort of, I wouldn't even call them documentaries. And in fact, to use the word documentary about this film is not.
It's a work of nonfiction, but it's not
exactly
technically.
I can't quite figure out what the word is. I call it a hybrid
essay film or.
Uh huh.
Yeah, whatever. People are always looking for that, right? That's potentially the most challenging thing is a lot of programmers don't want to struggle for that because they figure that their audience needs to get it immediately what they're looking at. Yeah. And you can't always do that.
No.
And then you're cheating the audience essentially too because
you're right
because
you're not giving them the chance to discover new thing.
You know?
Well, it's very interesting observation, Adam, because I was surprised, but I won't mention the festival. Because, but it got the film got accepted into the competition there. You know, they didn't have like an experimental section. They had a documentary section and a fiction section. So it was accepted into the documentary section. I found out from someone who was on the jury that the head of the jury instructed everybody on the jury not to vote for my film for anything because it was, quote, not a documentary. And I just was like, when I heard that, first of all, I had to laugh a little bit, you know, because it just shows you that pomposity and elitism, right? Aesthetic elitism exists in every aspect of the filmmaking business, not just Hollywood. You know, the independent business is
oh yeah, I see what you're saying.
It's just as exclusive and close-minded, and it's like what the fuck just. Why call it anything? Just watch
also,
the movie.
The head of the jury is at odds with the programmers because they decided that your film was a documentary for the purposes of this particular in terms of programming it. So then, you know, why should this mutinize?
I agree.
You know, and do that. That's
I know. Why not let them make up their minds?
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
It's, yeah.
But certainly the early films of Herzog, some of his. Because I wouldn't really call them documentaries. He did a film called Fata Morgana.
Mm-hmm.
He did a film about a sculptor who was also a ski jumper called The Ecstasy of the Sculptor Steiner. And it has the most amazing slow motion footage.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen
it? He crashes into the... Gets really injured though, or doesn't he?
No, he doesn't. Get injured
because he was the first one that learned how to basically
ski flying.
So they redesigned. There was a certain point where they were paralleling, and then where later on they learned in order to avoid accidents that they had to kind of cross their skis, and there was a different design and things like that. But I remember that work, and in fact, I just saw Herzog. He was in Brooklyn about a month ago. Did you hear about that? Where he's at Pratt.
I heard about it, yeah.
Even though it was free,
you had to RSVP and get a, you know, a ticket. Somebody gave me a ticket, so I went. And they showed the clip from that film.
Oh, very cool.
Yeah, yeah. But continue, so I'm sorry.
Yeah, but they're... I'm just saying, his films were about a subject that then elevated it or kind of even went deeper into it to such a degree that it became a little surreal. And you entered, for sure. You entered another level of awareness. And that's what I was attempting to do with this film. I mean, it's most assuredly not a documentary about the subway. It's all shot on the subway. But it's a journey. It's like this idea of how we even came up with the title is that I began to really see that it's like an alternate universe down there, you know, and on one level, you can just say it's people sitting on the train.
Mm-hmm.
On another level, it's quite different, especially when you consider the fact that it's probably the largest subway system in the world, I think.
Yeah.
And the numbers of people...
Unless there's something in China that we don't know about.
The numbers of people that use it are just so astounding. And so that when people enter the system, they almost become or feel that they become invisible because there's so much humanity around them. Well, and so thinking that they're invisible, I've noticed that people actually reveal things because they think no one can see them, right? Hmm. And so those were the moments that I was after. And it became like, it's almost like this was a flip side to the world that's above ground. You know, something that's a little more meaningful, a little bit more resonant. And that was the structure that I gave the film.
It's interesting, this alternative existence underground. It's sort of a whole other set of rules in a way, you know.
It's almost like being in outer space or underwater.
Yeah.
Because everybody's in these little capsules.
Right.
That are just hurtling through darkness.
Right, exactly.
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
You're in these little... self-contained little bubbles of light,
right?
You know, that move,
and we try desperately to normalize that experience too.
Mm-hmm.
Whether it's looking at your phone now, as everybody does, if you look around, that's another film.
Mm-hmm.
Where did the title come from, or do you just remember?
I just sort of came up with the words. I wanted something that
because I know a song like that's called that.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
I think so, unless I'm mistaken. You already said that as you were making it, were understanding what you were doing, and it was taking shape in your mind and maybe in your editing and et cetera, that you felt there was definitely an audience for it and that people would be able to relate to it. Were you thinking about whomever that those people looked like or that number of people? Because you've run, you know, it's obviously the biggest challenge for any filmmaker, let alone somebody who's doing something that you could call experimental or where you really isolate yourself from those commercial considerations almost entirely. I understand you do feel like people can relate to it, and I absolutely agree with you. But how has it been for somebody who's been making more on the surface commercial types of fare? Well, I mean, one could argue that there's
that's a really good question. Yeah. And I have to tell you that there's no difference, honestly, because every one of my films, I have faced the most just astounding challenges to just get them in front of people.
Right.
So this isn't new to me. In some ways, it's a relief to not have to worry about...
Well, the people that you're disappointing or frustrating because...
Or let's say a distributor had paid, you know, advance of $1 million and now I have to worry about opening weekend, you know, and reviews and all that shit, you know. I don't have to worry about it. And listen, it just feels good to have made something that I'm proud of and that I feel has meaning and you know, it's I don't expect it to get mass audiences, but I do think that it's a highly entertaining film. You know, the one thing that I will say is that I made a conscious effort to keep it always like, what's going to happen next? Once you lose that in a movie, I don't care what it is, when the audience doesn't give a shit what happens next, or they feel like whatever happens next, they don't care about, right? you're gone. The movie's gone. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. and it's a crucial element. It's not like action. It's not like, oh, it's just the sense that the film is proceeding towards something. And the element of surprise is still possible. And I tried to work that into this movie. But yeah, you know, IFC, you know, we tried to get, you know, more than one night. You know, I appreciate that. But I do think the film could have had a weak run there, and it may still somewhere,
mm-hmm.
you know, when we see what sort of reactions people have. But I mean, here it is. It's just under a month away from the screening, and it's almost sold out with no advertising whatsoever. So right. that's...
Yeah. Word of mouth.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's no doubt you could have had a good... And also, I think, frankly, I mean, I talk about this all the time. People are probably that listen to this are bored out of their mind hearing me say this, but I don't necessarily think there are very many films that need a full week theatrical. By and large, you know, you have a theater, they need to fill the... They need to screen films, I suppose, and they need to figure out a schedule where each weekend, which is when they get 90%, I'm sure, of their business is on the weekend. There's almost no film anymore where I can't go on the second weekend and know that I could just roll up and see any movie I want because right. by the second weekend, almost every film is already
gone.
Yeah, if it's still around for a second week, it's at like a much smaller capacity
right.
audience-wise. So
right.
I always feel like, man, if there was a way where you could just have a weekend theatricals, that to me makes most sense. And when I say weekend, I just mean Friday and Saturday.
Uh-huh.
I mean, Sunday, I guess, too, it could be, but not mm-hmm. by Sunday night, you're done.
Because
mm-hmm. nobody's going to the movies. I mean, when I say nobody, mm-hmm. very few people are going to the movies on Sunday night, let alone Monday and Tuesday and mm-hmm. Wednesday. It's just so quiet.
Mm-hmm.
You ever go to a movie on a Wednesday afternoon in any theater? No.
No.
Nobody else does either, Tom. I mean, they just don't. So the theaters are sitting there more or less empty most of the week. I mean... With very few exceptions, you know, the system is kind of broken. I don't know how a lot of these theaters, I guess they can do things like play your movie on a Monday night because the audiences aren't going to be showing up in droves for the other films right. that are there for the week. So I think right. that this definitely could have used, I think, a good strong weekend. And if you could somehow manage to change it so that, you know, you get your reviews for just a weekend, even a weekend, which is screenings, I think that would be great. And you absolutely would get a review if it were okay to review films that are just playing for a weekend
right.
because you have such an impressive track record. So that's my thought. I feel like a big part of the theatrical exhibition system is kind of broken.
Yeah, I would agree. Yeah. I would agree. You know, which ties into the whole, you know, critical
yeah, exactly.
connection too.
Right. Sure, sure, of course.
But, you know, that's the system. It is and, you know, listen, you know, Adam, I'm glad I made a film that was outside the system. I really, you know, the fact that I don't have to worry about reviews, I just, you know.
Mm-hmm. Liberating.
It's liberating. Yeah, yeah. It's also, I think, more natural. It's more,
it is organic.
It's more organic.
It is, because these things like reviews shouldn't affect anything.
Right.
They should,
exactly.
Word of mouth is...
It should be an... Review should be an afterthought, if that.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, the only thing that matters is to... It all... Listen, let's not get too, you know, artsy-fartsy here, but...
Where else are we going to get artsy-fartsy if
I'm
not
just
here?
Saying, you know...
Yeah.
If you want to be in the film business, you have to realize
it's a business.
It's a business, and it takes a lot of money on all aspects of it. You know, you might be able to make a film cheaply now, but nonetheless, to get it out into the world still costs money.
Right.
If someone is going to spend money, it's common sense. They're not going to do that unless they know they're going to get their money back, which influences what they accept to release and how they release it. You know, and it's a strange, strange cycle. But it just seems to me that I recall films. I mean, I'll tell you something that's really encouraging. That Moonlight won Best Picture. I mean, that is like incomprehensible to me, considering, right? But considering that Rocky won Best Picture. Do you understand what I'm saying?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean,
well,
I don't care what anybody says. Rocky is a stupid movie, you know?
You're talking about 40 years ago, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Rocky.
which, you know, spawns
it
Creed,
won
you know.
Best picture. Okay, that's all right. I'm not being elitist. I'm just saying.
But it was that was an independent film too.
I know it, but still, look at it.
Yeah. And it was opposite Network and Taxi Driver, by the way.
I know that. Yes.
Right? Wasn't Network the same year?
That's astounding. But the fact that Moonlight won, that is encouraging because I really liked that film. And I thought it was a really, really brave and difficult film. I
mean, which one?
Moonlight.
Oh, Moonlight. Yeah. Very true. Yeah, I agree with you. It was really very, very moving. And that it could, you know, win Best Picture or almost not win Best Picture, but then win Best Picture.
Right. Listen, I plan to get back into the, you know, the fray because that's what it is. It's a fray.
It's a fray.
What I mean by that is you gotta accept the fact that you have to push and shove and kind of get attention and try to get attention. Accept it that that's part of what the business is.
Yeah.
You know, you cannot be an independent filmmaker today and just sit back and wait for it to happen.
It's no.
it'll you know, you have to fight and you know, I wanted to get this one out of my system. You know, I may make another one like this, but just doing it all on my own was completely exhilarating. And you know, I have several ideas for scripts that involve actors, you know, mm-hmm. narratives. Mm-hmm. But doing this movie has shown me that if it came down to it, I would rather take my little camera, hire unknowns,
mm-hmm.
and just make the film exactly the way I want to make it.
Mm-hmm.
And time after time, that has proven to be true. Again, let's just talk about Moonlight. Who's in that movie?
No, nobody. There were no stars in it. I mean, you know, I guess...
But still,
you want the actor Mahershala, one who played, the drug dealer, the father figure in the first act.
But still, what
he's pretty famous because he's on House of Cards.
Yes, but come on,
you know, but there weren't any big star name above the title type of name, you know, in that film.
It
couldn't have cost very much.
Adam, what it's been like on every single movie that I've made, you know, just trying to get the financing.
I remember you just telling me, and it's what I hear also from your colleagues.
Well, even my very first film, Johnny Suede,
mm-hmm.
I met this young unknown actor who had come in to audition for me. This was my first film.
Yep.
You know, we had looked and looked and looked and could not find someone to play this part because either they just were too stupid or they didn't get it that there was a vulnerability to this character. You know,
mm-hmm.
And my casting director said to me, "There's this young guy coming in today. You know, when you look at his resume, don't be freaked out.
Judgmental about him because
he's got one little tiny Canadian TV series on it, and this movie that's just finished shooting that nobody has seen called Thelma and Louise." I looked at his picture. I said, "He looks interesting. Bring him in."
Mm-hmm.
The second I saw Brad Pitt walk in, I said two things. A, this is my guy. This is Johnny Suede.
Mm-hmm.
And B, this guy's going to be a star. All right. I cast him. I call the agent. Yep, you're cast. My producer goes, whoa. What are you talking about? You're not casting that guy. I said, this was like a $500,000 movie in 1991. He goes, yeah, I'm not paying for that guy. He's nobody. He refused to compromise in any way. I had to turn my back on this guy's money.
Really?
Yes, so, I did. That's how confident I was that Brad was the guy. You know how long it took me to get $500,000? It took 4 years.
Wow.
I walked away from it. And fortunately, you know, I stumbled into another deal 2 weeks later.
Wow. But you didn't know that.
I didn't know that.
Obviously.
But, you know, I had kept this one woman sort of aware of what was happening. And still, no, there was no guarantee that she...
Did Brad Pitt know what you did? Yeah, that would have been... kind of foolish. Unfortunately, it turned out well for you in every way. And it's a terrific movie if you haven't seen it.
So it's just like when you fight those battles, it's like, I don't know. It's, you know, every movie that I've ever seen that's really meant something to me
mm-hmm.
has had basically, you know, people doing parts that they either normally would never do,
mm-hmm.
right? Like even like Midnight Cowboy, you know, they almost didn't cast John Voight in that part.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he's astonishing in it.
Yeah.
So it's a struggle. I would love to make a movie completely they want to make it, and yet still have it get seen by a lot of audience.
Yeah. Wow. Write that down. Let's see. Get that. You know, where you have complete control. I think it is what you want.
Or I'm dealing with a company that isn't, you know, so myopic and just stupid in terms of, you know, what they think marketability is.
Yeah. There's so many distributors, but, you know, I don't know how many are willing to really step out, you know, and take a real artistic risk, you know, like they probably just look like it, the bottom line, they can't really afford too many missteps in the kinds of films they choose, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know. Was it different in 1991 and 1993?
It was a little different because everyone still had this thought. The distributors had since it was still such a wide open game that they figured that one of the hit films might hit, you know, that, you know, since it happened with a couple of films, it happened.
Yeah, and you were talking about like Sex, Lies, and Videotape and Reservoir Dogs.
Well, this was, before Reservoir Dogs. I think Stranger Than Paradise. That became the next sort of like thing for people to look up to.
Well, you shot that.
I did shoot that. Yes.
Coincidentally.
Yes. but the thing that changed all that was Pulp Fiction, which set the bar to a ridiculously high
point. That was the beginning of the end. That was the jaws of the independent.
It was.
Or the Rocky.
So, but it was different. I mean, there was definitely a sense that that if you got the film made, which was a miracle, and you got a distributor, well, there was never any question. Once you got a distributor, let's say in 1991, 1995, there was never any question that the film wasn't going to get a theatrical release.
Right. Yeah.
There were no other options.
Yeah.
And so that was such a great feeling.
Yeah.
Knowing that even if it played for a week or whatever, you were going to get a beautiful theatrical release. And I still just believe that the theater going experience is a valuable experience.
Sure.
No.
Yeah. Well, I guess a lot of other people feel that way too. I mean, there's no shortage of theaters, and they're being built. They're not
right.
They're adding new. They're adding theaters to the city. This
one,
yeah,
good,
yeah. So you know, I'm sure I've already talked to you about that, the Metrograph, and all these other theaters that, you know, that are playing films like this. How did you originally meet Buscemi? Then how did that happen? I know he was a downtown guy who, you know, you probably just ran in the same circles, right?
I knew who he was. I mean, one of the most fascinating things about being on the Lower East Side at that time, I first moved to the city in 1976.
The year Rocky came out, by the way. Where were you living before?
I had just gotten my bachelor's degree in creative writing
from
Old Dominion University in Virginia.
Oh, okay.
And I got accepted to NYU Film School. The graduate film school. So I decided to come up here.
Well, where were you? Where do I know where you're from? I'm trying to remember.
My dad was in the Marine Corps, so I was moving around every 2 years. But at that point, I had just finished 4 years in Virginia college in Norfolk, Virginia. But what I was going to say is I would walk to school, you know, from my loft in Tribeca to East 3rd Street. Everything that you saw on the streets was all done by posters and like handbills. You'd see new bands, you'd see theater groups, you'd see, you know, all this stuff on lampposts everywhere. And one of the things that kept appearing was Steve Buscemi with his partner, Mark Boone Jr., right? Going to be performing midnight at the Limbo Lounge or
midnight,
you know, at the Mud Club. So I went to see him a couple times because, I knew him through Jim. I think the first film that Steve did with Jarmusch was Mystery Train. But I went to go see Steve, he did this most amazing play in which there was hardly any dialogue at all for the first 45 minutes. It's just two guys, him and his
Boone.
Mark Boone Jr., on these little cots. And they kind of walk around sniffing each other and kind of pushing each other and curling up and trying to go to sleep. And after about 35 minutes, one of them says, "Okay, now listen, this time I'll be the male dog, you be the female dog." They were like dogs for 30 minutes. It was so brilliant.
Yeah. And, you could do it. It was part of a whole, you know, there was a process of experimenting. It wasn't like, here's this one thing. It's got to be a commercial success.
Right.
It's just like, well, this one, if it doesn't work, we'll go to the next thing. You know,
it was still entertaining as hell. It was hilarious and kind of spooky and with a real sort of surprise at the end. And we just became friends. At one point, I had spoken to him because I had originated Johnny Suede as a one-man show that I performed, right? And when I turned it into a screenplay, you know, I loved Steve, and I thought about him playing, you know, in the movie with me.
Yeah.
You know, but all of that quickly changed when I realized that I didn't really feel comfortable directing the film and acting in it for my first film, you know? So anyway, you know, I put him in Living in Oblivion, and you know, my admiration and love for him just, you know, skyrocketed. He is absolutely an anomaly in terms of an actor. I don't think I've ever met another actor who is so completely selfless, but yet brings his entire self. Now, do you know what I mean by that? Most actors, and I'm not being critical, okay? You have to hear me on this. Most actors are so self-obsessed that all they can think about is themselves. And in fact, there's a really basic acting exercise developed by Sanford Meisner called the Meisner Technique, in which all it is two people just sitting and looking at each other. And it's to develop the actor's you know, awareness of being, taking attention off of himself and putting it on the other actor. In other words, the other actor forces him to act. It's not just the actor acting by himself. You understand what I'm saying? Buscemi, I never made one suggestion to him that he looked at me and said, fuck you, I'm not doing that. You know, he either could have either smiled. Most of the time what he did was he would just kind of smile. And, you know, I would always take the actors aside and I just whisper to them. I don't make broad announcements that everyone can hear. I whispered to the actors and I whispered something to them, just a little thought. And his eyes just lit up. I went back, sat by the camera, action, you know. And then you just watch him take off. And it's, he flies. He goes wherever, you know, he wants to, but yet it's always within the realm of the film, which is another rarity. A lot of people give you their gifts, their acting gifts, but it doesn't always go with what the story is in some way, you know. And he's turned into a great friend. I think he's a really, really great filmmaker as well. You know, and I love the guy.
And he'll be there on June 19th to moderate the Q&A. That's going to be fun to watch.
Yeah.
Well, thanks.
Thanks, Adam.
Yeah, this has been great.
Yes.
You know, it's nice to be on the other end of this thing. Yeah. Is there in your New York premiere, I think it was? Was Woodstock your New York premiere?
Well, out of state.
What?
Out of state, New York. Here's the Gary Winogrand.
Oh yeah. I want to take a quick look at it. Yeah, that's beautiful. Yeah, I love street photographers, and look at that. Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, especially this one. She's beautiful. Look how beautiful she is.
But look at that. Isn't that beautiful? Through some of these things,
I'm going to.
Like, you know, just these little moments.
Yeah. Right.
They become surreal. Like this is a famous picture.
Is it? Oh yeah.
It's incredible.
I know. Yeah.
But I tried to take that idea and use it with the moving image.
This is amazing.
I know.
I'm looking at a young woman's, I'm looking at a woman from in the pool, under the surface, swimming with a pig, a piglet, or a small pig. It's really fun. This is a great book. It's been great. Thank you. It's been nice to see you. There's a word for what you do. There's a word for it. And we both know it too. Lord, it's nothing but nice, but it cuts you like a knife and leaves another hole in you. There's a name for the baby. There's a name for what you do.
As I mentioned, Karen Cooper has been, decades now. She's been programming Film Forum. She really is an icon in the world of programming. She's kept this theater going, obviously not alone. She's just working with a team of people that are really, really good at what they do. And Karen is certainly a great example of that in the kind of programming they do, because it's just sort of anybody's guess what's going to be a hit and what's not. So we get a bit into that nitty-gritty in this conversation. I mean, why bring on a programmer if you're not going to pick their brains about how they do their job? I mean, how do you know what's going to be? The answer is you just don't know, but you get a sense of what might be good, and you have to trust your instincts. And programming is a bit smarts, and it's a bit instincts, and who knows what else. So we hear a little bit of that from Karen. Plus, what makes a good bucket of popcorn? So we get into that too. And also what's coming up at Film Forum. I hope not all of it is past tense at this stage now that I think about it. But anyway, here we go. My conversation with Film Forum's Karen Cooper.
Does one begin? Let me just describe things to listeners. I'm interviewing Karen Cooper, who is an institution herself, just like Film Forum. You just refresh my memory. I want to say you're a founder of the Film Forum. I know you go back to the original location.
Right. But I'm not the founder.
But you're not the founder. You can't. No. They hired you.
A little grayer. The area.
Okay. I'm sure you've gone over the story once or twice before, but humor me.
Couple of years out of college, I was writing for a very undistinguished film magazine and writing about what was happening in exhibition and about Film Forum, which was a tiny loft space on the Upper West Side with 50 folding chairs and a 16-millimeter projector the size of a large toaster. And thought Film Forum was doing a terrific job. Peter Feinstein was one of two founders, but in its second year of existence was the only one left. So this was now, the spring of 72. And we had dinner one day, and Peter said, "Can't go on like this. Can't make $100 a week forever, leaving town, getting married. Do you want to take over the business?" And I asked what the business consisted of. I'd never run a business. I was all of 24. And he gave me a suitcase of those purple mimeographed copies of letters, which before there were Xerox machines. We're going back to the Jurassic period here.
And I remember them.
I read his copies. Loved the film because, hated the film because. And I thought, gee, I was an English major. I can write those letters. This isn't so hard. And of course, the place grew over many decades incrementally, but it really was a tiny little operation.
Yeah. Film Forum is located on West Houston, where it's been for some time. Is it the third?
Fourth.
The fourth location?
Yes.
Okay.
Fourth incarnation.
Thank you for...
Yes.
Okay, very good. And it seems to be the permanent spot for the first...
I would say so, yeah.
And it's on year 40 what?
Well, my anniversary? Well, you do the math.
Okay.
So it's 72.
72,
so it's
that 40, I can do.
40 plus years, yep.
Okay, this is your entire life. It's really remarkable when you put it in that context. Does that ever, do you ever like think, oh, I could have done this or I should have done that, or why didn't I try something different? Have
Actually,
you ever been really, really tempted
no, I'm
to just?
I'm kind of a monomaniac. So once I
this fits you.
Started it, it fit, and it. People think running a business is about. Running a business. It's actually about solving problems. And the most interesting problem is, of course, what you put on the screen.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the most exciting part of the job. But there are a lot of other things that come into it that have to do with technology and changes and personalities and how A fits into B and writing. I mean, I was someone who fancied myself a writer, and I do write the press releases and calendar copy, and so language is a big part of what I deal in.
Right. You were obviously never that tempted, because I'm sure there must have been offers along the way.
No, actually, there's never. No one has ever tried to hire me away. I am so ensconced. I guess I'm really not famed as a team player.
Oh.
You know, I'm really my own little Idaho, yeah.
You've existed in your own
isolated. Yeah, I'm afraid
so, yeah. Okay, well, you've done an outstanding job. Let's just
Thank you.
Be honest here. There's no doubt about it. Film Forum has a pretty amazing reputation. And a lot of pedigree at this
point. Well, I think certainly some of that is due to the extraordinary work that Bruce Goldstein does as director of repertory programming. And Bruce began that part of what it is we do back in the late 80s and has continued to do the most extraordinary work in bringing classic films to the screen and finding movies that are previously undiscovered, finding and encouraging studios to restore prints that previously only existed in some broken down form. So I think it's really the symbiotic nature of the old films that Bruce finds and brings back to life, and the new films that Mike Maggiore and I select to show that gives the place a certain dynamic.
That's exactly what Bruce said.
Well, he was right.
You and Mike are programming the contemporary cinema.
Exactly. For premieres.
Premieres.
All New York City theatrical premieres.
Gotcha. And one screen, so one screen is dedicated to the repertory and the other screen. I'm just playing devil's advocate.
The third
one
screen
is for premieres.
Is kind of catch as catch can. If something does particularly well.
Oh, you had that.
One, we have the ability to move it over and continue it running. Or we make other deals outside of our calendar deals and for films that we think have greater outreach. I mean, I Am Not Your Negro, the film by Raoul Peck.
Raoul Peck and his brother, on
James Baldwin's writing, has been running now for about 10 weeks.
Yeah, well, that was an Oscar-worthy.
Yes, should have won the Oscar.
Should have.
Absolutely.
And that's a nice... Let's take that as an example, because you brought it up. Could you foresee that success? Did you have a sense that this would probably have a good run? I don't want you to have to say, I don't know what I'm doing. But
you can and you can't. Mm-hmm. Both Mike and I felt it was an extremely strong documentary that did something entirely different when dealing with race relations by bringing back Baldwin's writing, which was so prescient and so really to the point in ways that I can't think of anyone who comes close to him.
It's true. There was a moment, if I recall, it's been a few months, where I think he just says exactly like how long it's going to take until there's a black president or something. He made a mention of it almost to the exact time, when Obama ended
up. The man's been dead almost 40 years, so that's pretty amazing.
It is.
As well.
Yeah.
But, to answer your question, the real answer is nobody knows anything. I mean, we thought it would do well, but as well as it is doing, no, we did not expect that. And a lot has to do with timing, how a particular film appeals or doesn't appeal to the public, and what kind of press coverage it gets, what kind of attention Raoul Peck received as the director.
Right. Right. There, so for as many examples of I Am Not Your Negro, there are as many that are...
Sure, that flop.
That flop. That's a good way of putting it. And we don't need to necessarily mention it. But there, so, and film form is a lot of a art house. I mean, it's almost entirely right, art house, I guess is a way to describe it. There is some indie films, like American Indies, creep in from time to time, right?
Oh, plenty of American Indies. Sure.
Yeah, yeah. That's another thing you have to balance, I suppose, too. Because
foreign and American work?
Yeah, and also stuff that's in some... Yeah, there's a couple of different demographics at play here, right? I mean, I remember when Computer Chess was here a few years back.
Sure.
And I believe, in fact, I had on the filmmaker, Andrew, at the office over on West Houston above the theater. And it seems like, this is like a Sundance hit, yet, it doesn't necessarily seem like the typical film form. But then I think about it and I figure that, film form also has to probably think about the age, group and demographics of their audience. I don't know.
We try not to be too strategic.
Okay.
I mean, I think you can overthink these things. Who's going to be interested in this film? And it's a good film, but is anyone going to come to it? In fact, if a film's a good film, it should be able to find its audience. We played a documentary called The Creeping Garden, only documentary on slime mold ever made. Now, that sounds ridiculous, but in fact, it was beautifully done. It was beautifully photographed. It was a gorgeous scientific film that had the sensibility of a science fiction drama. And it was like nothing else I'd ever seen. Did it have a big audience? Nah. But it certainly had an audience of people who read the Science Times or read Scientific American or, you know, majored in biology. And I am actually not none of those people. Okay, I read the Science Times. But it was just a wonderful combination of visuals and scientific insights.
Were you having great conversations afterward then? I mean, it seems like that film would, as most do, would lend itself to a good Q&A afterwards.
Both filmmakers were here. Uh-huh. And I have to confess, I'm generally, it's generally Mike Maggiore and not I, is the person who
moderating or present.
Sort of face at the theater.
Yeah, I understand. Do you occasionally do it?
Occasionally okay. I do it. Yes, okay. I do.
Okay. I didn't know if it was.
Sure. No, no.
You did mention you're a very private person. That's one of the reasons why I was very excited, actually, to sit with you. So, and I appreciate it. Well, I know that sounded like a film, The Creeping Garden.
Is that Garden,
like,
yes.
I remember it. The synapses are tingling a little. I do recall that, but I didn't see it. I didn't see it. But I just imagine that if the filmmakers are available, they should come to, it would make sense that they would try to come to as many screenings as,
sure.
as they
and
can.
Do. Yeah. They do, yeah.
Yeah, because especially, I mean,
they came
in the evenings.
From England specifically for the opening.
Oh, okay.
And I don't think the film had ever played in a theater before.
There's so much of their gardens, those British, you know. Anyway.
You know, there's a great Dutch garden movie I played just a few months ago called Portrait of a Garden.
Oh.
That follows two men who are horticulturalists who've taken care of a garden that's about 300-400 years old. And it's just a wonderful year within the garden that you spend. You know, again, gorgeous cinematography and an appreciation of nature.
I don't want to help Bruce out, but I smell a retrospective of sorts, like Green Thumb Festival or sorts.
You know, Bruce is really his own own man. I don't see him, Bruce, doing the Green Thumb Film Festival.
Yeah, I think it's a natural. I think we're going to get a, think about how many people love gardening, you know. You get all the British expats coming. Mm-hmm. Of course, they all love gardening. And then you could play Being There. And I noticed that you have a bunch of postcards and programs fanned out over the table here. Do you want to tell me, let's see, some of these things that are coming up.
Sure.
There's a new film called Reservoir Dogs.
Reservoir Dogs is a repertory release, and I certainly recall it, but I'm no expert.
Have you not seen it?
Oh, I've seen it from years ago when it was originally released. I'm on more solid ground talking about the premieres. We're opening Obit, which is a documentary filmed in the New York Times obituary desk and features a number of writers who really bring to life all those dead folks. I mean, it's a surprisingly funny and compassionate and humane film for a subject that you would think would be terribly depressing. It's not at all. It's really quite wonderful.
Well, most of those obits actually focus on the life of the person, so therefore it's a little bit of an homage or celebration of a life, usually.
Exactly.
And to hear some of these anecdotes, because I saw the film at Tribeca last year. In fact, I did have the filmmaker on my podcast.
Vanessa Gould.
Vanessa, right, and her producer, Caitlin Burke, I think. And I was going to, you know, across the street from Susan Norgate, I was thinking maybe I'll stop by and say, you know, you get me some of the Obit writers on, I'll do another piece on it. You know, let's do another piece on the on the film. It's worthy of it. You know, I saw it was at Tribeca last year.
Mm-hmm.
So,
yeah,
it's a great documentary.
Beautiful.
Very entertaining. Again, my mind goes to perhaps down the road, a retrospective. I'm going to be doing a screening with Bob Mankoff and some of the cartoonist editors at DCTV. I have my own little film series called Docularius, which are funny docs about funny subjects or comic subjects. Because we all need laughter in our lives at the stage, especially.
At any stage.
But in particular now, even though it's on HBO, but Bob Mankoff doesn't come to your home and talk to you after you've seen it on HBO. And it's another very, very just really fun documentary. And, you know, and it kind of played nice with Obit, actually, even though they're very different. And they're different, journals, of course. But
of course.
Anyway, sorry I interrupted you.
No, no, not at all. Following Obit in the middle of May, early May, May 10, we're opening Manifesto, which is based on the Armory show at the Park Avenue Armory, which was a multi-channel video installation with the actress Kate Blanchett playing 13 different roles.
I did read something
about
that.
And she's really extraordinary. She's chameleon-like.
Yeah.
I mean, unrecognizable. She plays a homeless person. She plays a very kind of slick TV announcer. She plays a sexy punk rocker. I mean, there could be 13 more disparate personalities.
Sounds like a one-woman show almost. Like,
it is
know,
a
one. Like,
it, that's exactly what it is.
Smith or something.
It's a one-woman show, but the text that she is reciting in these various vignettes, it is each one is a different manifesto by whether it's, I'm not sure if I have the authors right, but we're talking about major folks from, you know, the Communist Manifesto to Dadaism to Klaus Oldenburg talking about pop art, minimalism, and so forth, and both political and artistic cultural manifestos that are very intense and, for the most part, very serious. But it's, the visuals are often very playful and over the top. So it's a great tension between the visuals and the text.
Okay, very good. I don't suppose Kate Blanchett will be here, but...
We can hope. We can hope, but we're not sure about her
The invitation's
schedule.
Out.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But I can tell you that Wendy Whalen will be at the theater, and she is a marvelous ballerina who spent several decades at the New York City Ballet as a principal dancer and has since retired from New York City Ballet.
Not Balanchine, but Peter Martin's
Well,
ballet,
I think
right?
she was there during the very end of Balanchine's era. She has since retired from the New York City Ballet, but has gone on to dance modern dance at the Joyce. And this is a documentary called Restless Creature, Wendy Whalen, which deals with that period in her life when she was making a transition. Mm-hmm. And it's fascinating because you don't think about, well, what happens to ballerinas when they're no longer in those tutus.
Right. When they age out, which can be like a short lifespan for a majority of them.
That's true.
You know, especially the Balanchine school because it really beats up your feet and legs. And
well, that's part of the whole subject is are the various injuries and... operations and you know coming back from those terrible situations that she had after dancing for decades.
Right, of course. I think I read the Suzanne Farrell or one of those ballerinas books. She danced for George Balanchine and quite fascinating. It's like a guy that is obviously one of the most brilliant people ever, and yet tortured so many young women. It's a give and take. Anyway, what was that called again?
It's called Restless Creature.
Restless Creature. Oh, there it is, with Wendy Whalen. And that's starting May 20th.
May 24th.
24th. Great.
And Wendy Whalen will be at the theater.
Oh, terrific.
I'm hoping opening night, maybe other nights as well.
This is a perfect film for Richard.
Okay, but it's,
distributing it, right?
He's not, in fact, the distributor of the film, although we have a lot of Kino Lorber films on the next calendar. But we work with a lot of distributors.
Well, I'm sure.
Obviously.
Well, of course. But I can understand why Kino would be a regular because they're distributing a lot of these art house films. It makes sense. Complete sense. That sounds like a great one. Any others that I can see? I'm asking, but I can see.
Yeah. We have an unusual number of dramas coming up this summer, one of which is very Chevrolian, set in...
It's in Claude?
Set on the border of Switzerland and France.
Okay.
And it stars two of France's most esteemed actresses, Nathalie Bai and Emmanuelle DeVos. And it's a psychological thriller in which one woman believes the other woman is responsible for a hit-and-run accident that killed her son. So they circle around each other in very kind of scary, creepy ways.
Yeah.
But two great actresses in a... You know, this gorgeous mountain setting in French-Swiss border. And that's called Mocha. M-O-K-A is the title of the film.
And it's a Dutch-French film, is that what you say?
It is a French-Swiss
French-Swiss. Excuse me, French-Swiss. Okay.
And the filmmaker is Frédéric Mermeau.
I love French cinema.
You're going to love it.
I'm going to. I take your word. Who is distributing that one? Just for my own.
Film Movement.
Film Movement.
Yeah, another company with a lot of very good films.
True. Yeah, that makes sense. Again, I would have said that one too. So I assume you go to Cannes.
Actually, I don't.
Do you not go?
I go to Cannes. I go to Berlin.
You go to Berlin, which is overlaps.
We divide the world. Yeah.
You do. You divide and conquer, as it were.
Well, we divide and hopefully make deals.
But wouldn't you be able to sort of decide who goes to what? Because he doesn't have to go to those.
No, he doesn't have to.
Well, how does going to Cannes help him put on a 75-year-old film about, you know?
No, you're thinking of Bruce. Mike goes to Cannes.
Oh, Mike, you said. I'm not listening very well.
Mike goes to Cannes, and he goes to Sundance and Toronto.
Oh, you don't go to Toronto. Okay.
I go to Berlin, and I go to the Amsterdam Documentary Film Festival every November. And usually at least one other festival.
Right.
So there was a year when Mike and I had grants to go to a number of festivals in South America and Asia. So I went to Yamagata.
And that's obviously in Japan.
Japan. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I think Mike went to Buenos Aires. And we've really kind of covered both the A list and the B and C list of festivals.
Yeah.
But the big ones really are Berlin, Cannes, Toronto, Sundance.
Is there a festival that you haven't been to that you really kind of would love to go to at some point? Maybe it just doesn't make sense.
There are parts of the world I'd love to go to that I haven't been to before. But festivals, as interesting as they can be, are not as critical as they once were. So many films that Mike and I look at, we see through streaming. I mean, we see them through professional sites, Vimeo sites. It's not as necessary as it once was to travel.
I understand. When you're looking at a film from a programmer's perspective or context, you're looking at it at a different way. Like when I watch films, and granted, I don't program for a film forum yet. I'm just kidding. I would love to one day. But you're looking at obviously how strong a film it is from a dramatic standpoint, let's say if it is a drama, in fact, or, you can watch it on a small screen at home or here at the office and tell. Watching it in a movie theater is always a nice option, but it isn't essential from the programmers.
Exactly.
If you're going as a movie lover and a film fan, that kind of thing, then, it's optimal to obviously see it on a beautiful projected, in a beautiful projected
I think
manner,
a strong film grabs you emotionally and it grabs you intellectually.
It can, right?
But
you still cheat yourself when you're seeing it maybe on a
15-inch. I think comedies are the ones where you get cheated because it's more fun
comedies.
To be with an audience that's laughing and
that's
that picks
true.
Up on things that you may be slower at picking up on. Especially those Eastern European comedies are tougher to get the humor.
Are you talking like the Romanian, how dry and slow the pace
and
the...
Okay. Dry, slow Romanians.
I would agree with that, yes.
The Life and Death of Mr. Lazarescu, a wonderful film.
Loved it.
I did get the humor of it sitting alone, but it's much funnier if you're with 100 other people who immediately see how ridiculous it is that two doctors are talking over a man's, body as he's suffering and talking about when they're going to take their next coffee break.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I mean, that kind of humor is
it lends itself to the... that infectiousness that you only get in a theater.
Yeah.
I agree with that. That's true. Or going to the film forum because you get some great popcorn, which you can't, necessarily get at home.
That's true. The secret of our popcorn, is that it's fresh. It's made every day, and what isn't sold is thrown out. The dirty secret of commercial theaters popcorn is they keep it at the end of the evening and they mix it in with the new stuff the next afternoon, and you're really eating a bunch of old popcorn and new popcorn. It's sort of, 50-50, depends on where they started. So you're eating stale corn.
This is
good.
An expose. I had no idea. I thought I knew everything about everything.
Stuff going on there. We also don't sell popcorn with butter, and I've had people complain, where's the butter?
Bring your own.
It's really a question I was told years ago by Dan Talbot, who runs the Lincoln Plaza, and before that had Cinema Studio and the New Yorker theaters, wonderful theaters.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he said, whatever you do, don't let popcorn in. You'll never get rid of the smell. So that's been our... That's
butter, the
wrong.
Butter,
the butter smell.
Right. I never
it gets
liked
rancid
butter on it.
And
yeah.
No.
Right. And it does good. Even when it's not. It does smell. You're going to get a smell.
Exactly.
And eventually it just becomes permanent.
That's what he said, and he
okay.
was right.
Yeah. So personally, I didn't expect that we'd be talking popcorn, but I'm perfectly happy to do it because I've always preferred just slightly salted. That's
yeah.
plenty.
Yeah.
You know. What do you think? I think I asked Bruce about this too. But what do you make now of the theaters like Alamo Drafthouse? I'm just curious what someone
specifically
who's been
Alamo
programmed.
Drafthouse, I haven't been there.
You haven't ever been?
No,
okay.
I haven't been. But there are a lot of new theaters, and I think it's terrific.
It's well, that's another question.
It creates a certain dynamic, and if people are getting more excited about going to movies instead of staying home and watching Netflix and streaming, I think that that's a good habit to get back into. There was a generation in the 60s and 70s in which the latest Godard movie or mm-hmm. Fellini film was the hottest thing everyone was talking about, rather than, you know, maybe Trump's press conference. I mean, it
which
really
is a daily
was,
event.
Really, exactly. It was breaking news.
Or the latest, you know, series that on
television,
whatever, on television,
yeah.
which has
so
replaced the
discussion. A lot of these new theaters, I mean, we are not in any sense challenged by them. We think it's only makes the landscape
oh, right.
more exciting.
I agree with that. I think that's true. That wasn't my question. I mean, I agree with that perspective that the more theaters out there, I think helps everybody because
yeah.
it gets people, again, you're right, into getting out. And once you're appreciating that experience, and if there's an emphasis in the theater of really trying to make the experience for the theater goer a positive one, then you'll say, oh, this is nicer than just staying home
sure.
another you know, Friday night
right.
or whatever. You
well,
know?
I think there's
and,
a generation that's really gotten stuck at home, and we have to get them out.
Yeah. Well, it's very expensive if you have kids to go to the movies, because not only are you paying for the movies, but you're also either bringing them or you're getting a sitter, potentially. It's,
exactly.
it's an expense. However, so the idea of watching something on Netflix becomes all of a sudden far more appealing. However, for those who aren't raising small children, let's say, or who just still prioritize going out to the theater, I see that a lot of the theaters, there is certainly a crop of new theaters or newly revamped theaters with additional rooms or new rooms. Mm-hmm. And also, I mentioned the Alamo Drafthouse only because, yes, they have a big theater in Multiplex in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, probably there's a wait and see how it does before more come to New York.
I think it's doing pretty well.
I think so. But, you know, they have really good, again, good programmers, and they're mm-hmm. doing things, and it's very pro. But they do enforce this no phone rule. They enforce,
enforce
no talking.
They'll
throw you out. I mean, would you
well,
throw people
our
out?
Our audience is self-enforcing.
It is.
I mean,
I
think our audience will throw you out if
yeah.
you talk. And we don't have any commercials. I mean, yeah. I think it's kind of silly to make a big deal about all your rules and how serious you are about your movies. If your audience is serious about the movies, if the programmers are serious about the movies, about getting the best films on the screen and not just mm-hmm. taking whatever is coming down the pike from Hollywood, then you're going to have a more well-behaved group of people who are watching what's up there.
The people that go to Film Forum, and it's the correct way to say it. You don't say the Film Forum. It's just Film Forum.
Film Forum.
Yeah.
Out of the article.
Got it. Those are people predisposed for kind of like a serious cinema. I don't mean to say they don't have a great sense of humor. I'm just,
yeah.
you know, or that they don't let their hair down and like to see comedy, whatever, action movie. But that they go and they are very good at self-policing in that regard. They're probably a little less likely to pull out a cell phone, let's say, or start a conversation in the middle of the movie than they are at your average multiplex, which is maybe playing the latest high stimulation film, like, you know,
yeah.
whatever superhero film or what have you. So, you know, that's my point. I guess this is, I'm going over obvious ground at this point, but I was just kind of curious what you thought about ordering a catfish sandwich and a beer while you're...
I think that's rough. I mean, people make noise when they're eating. Their utensils make noise. The waiter makes noise. How do you pay for the damn thing? I think it really...
Credit card, yeah.
Credit card. But even so,
or
it's
cash,
dark
yeah.
and, you know...
Yeah, they come by.
I think it's a distraction.
It's
I think
a little
it's
a
tremendous
bit.
Distraction. I mean, if you're reading a book, would you want somebody putting food in your face while you're doing that? And I think watching a movie should be an immersive experience if it's a good movie.
Mm-hmm.
If it's worth watching, it should be worth watching and not eating at the same time. Or at least if you're eating, to my mind, it should be something that's pretty easy to eat, like a bag of popcorn. So I'm not enamored of this dining and watching movies experience. Maybe in Kansas City it's okay. There's a New Yorker in me speaking. Just that there are so many good restaurants in New York that to have to go to a particular movie house to both eat and see the movie, I would rather go to the restaurant I want to go to and do that before I...
Why cheat yourself? Go ahead, do both that night, you know? By the way, I think Karen was referring to Kansas City, Kansas. If you're listening, not Kansas City, Iowa, just to be, because we don't want to lose any of my Iowa listeners. You know, it's a very big film state. I'm going to make sure I got to everything before you. Other than that's two or three festivals, though, do you go out to the movies at all? I mean, I know we've established you have to watch. Your schedule is such that you're streaming or you're at the film
floor. I stay in for movies. I go almost every weekend. I spend several hours looking at Vimeos. But yes, the truth is, I do go out to movies and I do see commercial work. My husband's a member of the Academy, so we get all those DVDs. Oh,
what does he do?
He is an animator.
George Griffin?
Yeah.
I say it like I'm familiar with him.
Of course, I do see commercial work, and I think that's important. I want to know what the landscape is like, and there are marvelous commercial films. I'm not... Mm-hmm. Someone who thinks it has to be an independent to me.
But you don't do a lot of the party going and events.
Just not
going.
My personality. Not a party animal.
No, I get it. Because you do have to put some of your attention into keeping aware or being aware of the landscape, as you just said. And so getting out and seeing these other movies that you're not likely to program is sometimes important too.
Absolutely.
Right. And an ear to the ground. So you must read a lot, I assume, Do you talk to other programmers a lot other than...
No.
Really? No, you did say at the beginning you were fairly isolated, so I understand.
Not particularly.
And it works for you. It's clear. Whatever you're doing, continue to do.
Well, thank you.
You know, people can go to filmforum.org, right? It is org, right?
Yes.
And they can download the program. You always have the latest films schedules up there. I'm checking it all the time. And you can join Filmforum.
You can
become a member.
It's a very good deal.
It is, right? Do you get discounts to the screenings?
For $75 a year, and students and seniors, $50, so a third off. You get in for $8 instead of $14, so it's really the best deal in town.
Right. So it makes complete sense. And it's very accessible. The theater is located
West Houston, just west of 6th Avenue. Very close to every subway that goes to West 4th Street.
Right. And the 1 train.
And the 1. And,
right by the 1 train as well, the Houston stop.
If you happen to live downtown, easy walking distance, Soho, the Village, NoHo.
Oh, this is great. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thank you.
You know, Karen Cooper, what's your official title, by the way?
Director
of Film Forum.
Correct.
I think you would be great. You don't give yourself enough credit. I think you should be in the lobby more and meet all your...
I could change the title to Tsarina. I'm sorry to think that might work.
Maybe then you can affect the government for the next president, too.
Right.
Thank you very much. It was a real pleasure to talk with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you, everybody, for listening to this episode. Please do subscribe to us on iTunes. Give us a star rating and a review. I ask you that every week, and I don't know. I guess you don't really take me seriously if you're listening. I mean, if you are hearing these words coming into your head right now, if my words are in your head, you know, inside of there, and I'm actually ordering you to go to iTunes and write up a review and give a star rating, how can you not do it? How can you not do it? Doesn't make any sense to me. You don't really have a choice. So go to iTunes, search FilmWax, subscribe. God forbid you haven't subscribed yet. I believe you must have subscribed, but if you haven't, subscribe. And just give us a star rating and a review. And what happens is when people search
other people that don't know about my podcast I'm talking about. I'm not talking about you. You know about my podcast and you listen to it. But for those who don't, the way they'll find it is if when they're looking at other similar kinds of podcasts, my podcast will come up as a suggestion. Or it'll come up in search results when they're searching for other film podcasts. That's what happens. It's starting to happen. So it does work. And then the more people that find it, you know, it just grows. It grows, it grows. So please do me the simple kindness of doing that. You can also find us on Facebook, of course, and like our page. That helps too. All these little things. You know, we have a newsletter. You can go to our website, filmwaxradio.com. And subscribe to the newsletter. You can go to Twitter or Instagram and follow what we're doing. It really makes a big difference. We're on YouTube. You can subscribe to our channel. We're on Stitcher. And as I mentioned recently, we're going to get ourselves onto Spotify. We're going to get ourselves onto SoundCloud proper. In other words, when I think about it, I sometimes put stuff up on SoundCloud, but I've got to get an account going, and I mean really get it going. So we'll do that. So people can find us everywhere. There's no excuse. Okay, everybody. Thanks for listening to Film Wax Radio, episode number 412. Film Wax Radio is your independent film interview podcast. We're presented by Rooftop Films. Thank you for listening. So until the next show, which is next week, please do take care of yourself and the ones you love. Bye-bye.
Broken strings, broken idols, broken heads.